Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Nina.
I'm so happy to have you on our first podcast that we are doing after we have launched the dedicated website for Food for the Soul.
Isn't it beautiful?
Well, it's taken a lot of effort of many people to get to the point that we are, and I'm very happy and proud of what we have, but obviously now we have to build it so that there would be a lot of exciting content. And The podcasts are something really, really new. In fact, this one probably would be the first one where I'm kind of introducing the subject, and then we can take the subject and fly with it.
Yeah, and we're talking about some of our favorite things.
Absolutely. and we hope to talk about some favorite things in many podcasts to come. But the idea is that we would kind of chat about things that either have struck us in art and culture or in the world around us, and then kind of have our thoughts on it. But what I wanted to say is that this one is kind of recorded in unusual circumstances, because obviously we're, like the rest of the world, on a complete lockdown now for several weeks. And we have, when we were thinking about starting those podcasts, we have not thought that these are the circumstances in which we will be.
Yeah, we thought talking. We'd be in London and Rome, and you'd be in New York and Chicago. Where were you? You were going to San Francisco. I mean, we were going to be all over the planet.
Well, this week, you and I would have been looking at the wonderful Raphael exhibition in Rome, but clearly we are not. But that's what gave us an impetus to have this conversation about survival, which is the subject that I wanted to kind of to tap your opinion, but also to maybe go back to some books and movies and stories that we know that are within the subject. And survival obviously is a very, very, very large term, which may mean the physical survival, the actual survival. And I'd love to talk about that as well. But obviously there is a psychological and economical component to that. And to this, I'm sure that you can speak very well to this. So how about we just plunge into the subject and then we see what we
absolutely
come up
with. Absolutely. And we're going to start with my favorite book, one of my all-time favorite books, right?
Well, which I have discovered is also one of my favorite books as well, which I have read independently, but I think you have much more to say about this subject, because I think you, as an editor and publisher of Solari Report, have interviewed the author of the book at some point, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me more?
One of the things, so we're talking about Deep Survival by Lawrence Gonzalez. And Lawrence Gonzalez's father in World War II had been a fighter pilot. And his plane had gotten hit, he ejected, and his parachute didn't open. And he fell all the way to the ground and lived. And for some reason, that interested his son tremendously in stories of who survive extreme experiences and why. And he started to work. He became a writer. He started to work for one of the National Geographic magazines. And they were always making it sound like it was a wonderful thing to go into the wilderness and run around. And one day he went to the publisher and he said, you know, to his editor, he said, you know, it's dangerous out there. We ought to warn people. And he started to write. The editor let him. He started to write stories about people who survive extreme wilderness experiences and why. And to everybody's surprise, it just really caught on. And he followed it up and wrote more and more and then turned it into a book. And it's Deep Survival is a series of wilderness people who endure and survive extreme wilderness experiences, and he's able to bring it down. First of all, it's beautifully written. So, you know, you start reading it. Don't start reading it at 7 p.m. at night, because you'll be up all night. You won't be able to put it down. But the second thing is he brought it down to a series of behavior practices, he wrote a distillation article called The 12 Rules of Survival that bring it down to the 12, what are the 12 things that the people who make it have in common? And I found that to be one of the great checklists for surviving anything. So I've never survived an extreme wilderness. I survived an extreme urban survival experience. But his lessons are, just as relevant. If you look at his summary document for the 12 Rules of Survival, or his subtitle for the book is Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why? And whenever you are in a period where, there's fear in the air, or you feel threatened, or the risk is really rising, this is a book to really help you get your perspective and envision a way to play to win in the situation, is the way I would say it. Now, you have one of the most interesting extreme urban survival stories I've ever heard. So one of the things I want you to do before we talk about this is tell everybody about your great Parisian adventure.
Oh, well, the Parisian adventure, maybe we should talk about in a minute. But going back to the book, what I have been struck about is the fact that there is this huge psychological component that is included in his advice. He does in the book also put this 12 points of how to survive list at the end of the book. And part of it is obviously the physical survival, which I can heartily kind of concur. And then there's this huge component, psychological component. The reason I'm saying is that I can kind of agree wholeheartedly to what he says about the physical survival, because in the United States, when kids go into scouting, that consists of selling cookies in front of the grocery store, as I have discovered. But I have actually grown up in a completely different type of scouting, where when I was I don't know, 10, 11, 12-year-old, I would spend a month or 6 weeks in a forest. And part of that training of kind of living in the forest, not only you build your own cots after you have cut down a tree and cut it into pieces and put it together and set up a tent and build a field kitchen and set up latrines or whatever. Everything was done by the kids without any other people involved. But also, there was, for example, a training that consisted of spending 24 hours in the forest by yourself. You had three matches and a knife, and that's all you had, and you had to manage. So after that kind of experience, I understand quite well what it means to kind of live in a forest or survive in a forest or in wilderness, because I did it as a kid as part of scouting training, but I have done it. So part of it is fabulous when he describes, the basic tenets of it that you have to learn, how to, find shelter and heat and possibly some food, but shelter and heat is probably the most important thing of survival in the wilderness. And the great part of it is psychological, which I think is something that would speak very well to a situation that half of the world is in right now, because as we all speak to each other, kind of trying to comfort each other in being in this lockdown, there's a lot of people I speak to who seem to be, for obvious, very, very important reasons, not necessarily even scared, but unsure of themselves or worried, right? Because the situation that we are in is new, something that we haven't encountered before. The outcome is not entirely sure, and obviously people are worried about various things, economical I issues, survival issues, literal survival, anything else that people are worried about. And that's where any survival guide would probably come in handy, as in, get the clarity of what is important and what is not. You know, try to keep the small positive goals in front of you. Don't think the big picture too much, because then you're going to get depressed or overwhelmed, but just break down the environment around you into small steps and small goals so that everything would feel manageable. And these are simple pieces of advice, but most of the time, when you're in an extreme situation, you don't think rationally, and this probably goes away. That's what I loved about the book and the movies that we probably are going to talk about in a minute.
For those who are interested, there's an interview in the Solari Library with Lawrence. There are several interviews with him, but the first one is on deep survival. And you can also link to, in the Solari one, the 12 Rules of Survival, which is his article summary of the key 12 steps. And one of the things I love about his work is he really shows you the power of believing you can do it. In other words, of having a picture in your mind that it's possible for you to succeed. Well, I used to have this wonderful ally when things looked hopeless. Somebody would say, oh, it's hopeless. And she'd say, well, but we're willing for it to not be hopeless. We're willing for it to work out, because she was trying to show people the importance of holding that. I'm a great believer that the energetics of a situation, you know, you create your energetics. So scripture says faith is the substance of things hoped for, but not yet seen. So the possibility of success doesn't necessarily exist, but can be created with your faith. And he really describes that.
Well, let's...
You still have to tell the Paris story.
There isn't that much to tell, but in very kind of broad strokes, like a lot of people in, you know, in Europe or United States, or, you know, kind of more economically advanced countries, I have grown up in a fairly comfortable life of, you know, you wake up, you go to work, you come back home, there are streets, there's people, your existence is more or less settled. In other words, it's not life in extreme poverty or extreme wilderness or some extreme circumstances where you have to fight for survival every day. So as a result, when you grow up in those kind of circumstances, you never think that anything bad is going to happen to you that much, because, you know, life is kind of very maybe mundane and simple, but predictable. And then I had the misfortune of going for the first time in my life to France, to Paris, for a couple of weeks vacation. But unfortunately, I was going from a country that was throes of political unrest. So I go to Paris, I visit museums. And
how old are you at this point?
Well, I was in my 20s. I wasn't a child, but as a matter of fact, I was
young. Was this your first trip abroad?
No. It wasn't my first trip abroad, but it was my first trip to a country in which at the time I didn't speak the language of that much.
Right.
So I basically had one suitcase, you know, a poetry of T.S. Eliot in my pocket, and that was it. And I was going for 2 weeks vacation. So I go there. I'm in the middle of this vacation, a week or two into this vacation, and then I go to bed as a normal person, and then I wake up the next day as a political refugee, because overnight my country has had a political coup and a martial law installed, and then I woke up as a refugee, you know, with no country to go back to. The borders got closed. I didn't really know anybody in Paris, and I didn't
speak the language
much.
So you're alone in Paris. You're 25 years old. You don't speak French. How much money did you have?
Oh, I don't know, maybe like 200 francs in my pocket.
And you had 200 francs.
And I'm in the middle of Paris, so you can suddenly become, you know, a boat people in the middle of, you know, beautiful capital of the world. Which taught me that you learn to speak the language perfectly very fast when you're hungry.
Yes.
So I did that. And I have survived with a lot of help, of course, of a lot of kindly strangers Lots and lots of them. They were wonderful
Well,
people.
I've visited Paris with you, and your French is quite good.
Well, right now, yes, my French is fine, but at the time was kind of interesting, but I have survived. But all I'm saying is that in a way, it is almost like a little bit like an experience that we all experience right now, meaning we have a kind of an established, ongoing life that is on a fairly stable track. And then you wake up in the morning and then you discover that your life is not that stable, that it gets completely upended by some external circumstances that you cannot control. So for me, since then, from my kind of childhood surviving in the forest experiences and that kind of Paris episode of, here I am comfortable in middle class and the next day I'm a nobody in the street. I have become quite fascinated with the survival themes in art, in literature, in movies, and in people's experiences, because I think it's something that can happen to anybody completely unexpectedly, and then how do you pull through it? I mean, I always kind of seek that kind of story. So that's why I love the Gonzalez book, which I think we both can heartily recommend to everybody, not only as a compendium of fascinating real life stories, but also because it has some good advice about how to manage the psychological aspect, even if you're not literally threatened by a T-Rex or an airplane going down, but just
Right.
the psychological part of it. But before we do that, also, or to continue that, could we also maybe talk about our favorite movies now that we are kind of stuck
Yes.
in front of our screens
So
nonstop?
if you look at all my favorite movies, there's so many that are survival movies with a happy ending. I used to get people would call me and say, I want to write an article, or do a documentary about your story. I said, no, I'm working on the happy ending. You can't, I won't tell the story until the ending's happy.
Well, because the happy ending gives us, I mean, we do not like as mankind probably to have our hopes dashed. So you build up a hope in the story and then you want a happy ending, even though in life it goes either way. So why don't we, you do one movie, I do another one, and we can kind of
Okay. You want me to start or you want to start?
go ahead.
Okay, so I had a wonderful company. We had a cash flow. I don't know, we had about $1 million a month of cash flow was rolling in, and we were doing superbly. And then, so one day I'm on the top of the world. I'm extremely wealthy because I made a lot of money on Wall Street. And I have an impeccable reputation and everything's perfect. And literally the next day you wake up. And you've got enforcement teams coming after you. You've got 18 audits of investigation, 12 tracks of litigation, and your cash flow, your expenses haven't changed, but your cash flow is zero.
That beats my
It's just,
Paris story, I think.
right. So it's just when the sheriff of Nottingham toots the horn, everybody scatters. I had a Rolodex of, It's funny, I went back and looked at my Rolodex at the time. It was all CEOs and partners of investment banks and law firms. And literally, all thousands stopped speaking to me in 24 hours. Suddenly, they blow the whistle, and everyone you thought was a friend doesn't know you. Anyway, so I'll never forget one of the things we did during that period. It was right after one of the most shocking events, was I decided to go see the movie, The Full Monty.
That's a little bit of a stretch, even though it is a survival story. Let's
It is a
say,
survival
let's talk
story, and
why.
I don't remember. I one of my partners wanted to see it, and I can't remember why. We were in, I can't remember if we were in San Francisco or Philadelphia. We were someplace trying to gin up credit. I forget the details, but it was kind of a flyer. And so The Full Monty is a British comedy. It was made in 97. And, if you looked at it at that time, there was nobody that I know of that was famous. I mean, I can't, I don't, I just don't know why we did it. But, It was a story of a group of people in a depressed area in England who were out of work. So it's with Sheffield in South Yorkshire. So all the steel mills closed, and everybody, nobody can get a job. And so these four, I think they were all ex-steel workers, but they're four people who are out of work, decide to start a striptease act. And they're trying to come up with something that's fun and entertaining. So they talk each other into this and they do a striptease act, which turns out to be absolutely fantastic. And, is kind of the talk of the town. And it's really about people under extremely economic adverse situation just saying, oh, to hell with it, and doing whatever they have to do to move on down the road. And in the process, they really get something accomplished.
Well,
Anyway, so it.
let's just clarify that the people who start the striptease are not women, they are men. They are all men.
Right.
So they are kind of
Right. So it's very
doing
funny.
well, that's where the gag is to a great extent, that they are these are men trying to survive as the striptease act in
Right.
the working class part of England, where men are not expected to do that kind of behavior, if they want to be respectable. And let's talk about the survival element of this. I mean,
So to me, the survival is, when you're in an economy, you generally build a comfortable niche doing something that's desired. When that economy changes, suddenly there's no way to generate an income inside your comfort zone. So you have to leave your comfort zone. And sometimes you have to leave your comfort zone, by many miles. And it shows you how a group of people using teamwork help each other go beyond their comfort zone in a way that's very, very funny. And the way I would call it is they jump the curve on their situation. So it's time. Jump the curve is sort of an entrepreneurial description that says, okay, we can't get here just turtling along. We've got to do a jump. It's a little bit, if you watch any of the space movies, when they leap into hyperspace, it's like, okay, we have to do a hyperspace. And these guys really took a huge leap outside of their comfort zone, and they used creativity to do it, and they really helped each other. They really helped each other be creative. It was fun. And I'm always talking about a state of amusement. I refuse to lose my state of amusement. And no matter how dire things are, there's a real advantage to keeping your state of amusement because, it's through the state of amusement that I find my creativity and I find a way to kind of jump the curve.
right, which is probably something that is going to resonate with millions upon millions of people on the planet right now, because there is so many of us who kind of find themselves in uncertainty once the lockdown or the quarantine draws over. It is not going to be evident for a lot of families to survive the way they were surviving before.
Well, I'll give you the perfect example. All my life, I had worked for large corporations and governments. So my financings, when my sort of change came, all my deals were, a $250 million deal was tiny. I did billion-dollar deals, huge, huge money swinging around. And so I'm sitting in my office after we're into the litigation, and I realized the corruption was so bad that I had to find a way to just work for people because it was the people who weren't corrupt, it was individuals. So I turned to my attorney and I said, we're going to have to find a way to support ourselves working for individuals. And she turned and looked at me like I was insane and she said, good luck, honey.
Well, she was very, very practical because it's not an
Well,
easy feat that you pulled off.
but here's the thing, that when if you look at Gonzalez's list, he talks about the importance of facing facts as fast as possible. And at that moment, when I realized I can't, the corruption is so bad, I can't work for corporations or government agencies. They're too, so it was a way of facing the pain early and moving out from there. And I never looked back. I kind of burned my boats and followed that rule. And it's truly saved me. Thank God I did. But, it's very, and you see that in the Full Monty, the thing that really threatens them is the time they waste not facing facts. But then when they say, okay, well, it is what it is. Let's move on. What can we do? And that's when they really start gathering their power. Because by the time they finish, they've really gathered tremendous power and respect.
Right. And also, it is a comedy, so this is something that we can probably highly recommend for those trying times, because that's what we crave. Unfortunately, my list, now that I looked at it, is almost entirely consists of drama. So I'll just, suggest one or two, and then we can go back to yours, maybe more uplifting
Okay.
fare.
Okay.
Because to speak to the Gonzalez's book, the movie that I like, millions of other people, of course, like very much, is The Martian, with Matt Damon and the famous potato scene, or the potato idea, because here is a story of someone who finds himself in a completely cut off from mankind. He's literally alone, and there's no one else to help him for months to come. So he has only two choices. Either he's going to survive or he's not going to survive. There's no third option there. And he comes up with this ingenious idea that in order to survive, he kind of reduces his options to absolute minimum, the way that any person who is in extreme circumstances has to do. He has to face the fact that unless he eats, he's not going to survive. In order to eat, if there is not enough food, he has to grow some. So that's when he starts
Right.
growing potatoes on a space station, which is not an easy thing to do, but he manages to do it. For me, there's a wonderful kind of reduction to the absolute minimum of what you absolutely have to do to survive, and facing the fact that
Right.
there is no the third team, not that, non that, or that you basically have no third option. So I love that movie, and it has
Can
a
I just say
wonderful
one thing?
ending. Yes.
One of my favorite little posters is a spin-off on the Staycom series. It says Stay Calm and Do the Math. And one of the things I love about the Martian is he's completely, one, he's facing a situation and then he's unpacking everything mathematically to what he has to do, today, tomorrow, the next hour, the next minute. But he's got the math all worked out on the potatoes.
If you have to get stuck in the wilderness, get stuck with a scientist, maybe. Or
Right.
at least in the space, maybe not the wilderness, but definitely in the space. To go on the other end of kind of to continue this subject on the wilderness, because that's what the Deep Survival book is mostly devoted to. I was quite fond of the early reality show, not that I watched them that much, but it was kind of very early of a fresh thing. It's a Canadian reality show called Survivor Man, not to be confused with the later one. The one that I'm talking about is actually a Canadian guy who literally goes into wilderness with a camera and survives. It's not the later one that stars an Australian survivalist who clearly is wearing makeup and has five cameramen and wardrobe styling behind him, and then tries to convince me that he's surviving in the wilderness. I think his name is Grills or something like this, and he was much more successful because everything was much more attractive. But I don't believe a second of what I'm watching there, because I can see the makeup, the cameras, the different angles, and the crew behind it. Whereas this one, it's called Survivor Man. It's a Canadian guy who would get dropped into wilderness, and like a period of time with a knife and a flashlight or something, and had to survive. And he kind of illustrates very well that kind of reduction to the most basic things that have to be accomplished just for him to be able to get through the day. Don't get wet, because then you're gonna get sick and You will not be able to walk through, let's say, a forest or a glacier or whatever it is. Don't find shelter early enough. Gather your firewood early enough so that when the dark comes, you don't get surprised by the dark without any heat or shelter, and so on and so on. But obviously, when I was watching it, it was fascinating, but also it kind of translated to me to kind of any survival, you know, urban survival or life survival stories as well, that sometimes you just have to break it down to the most basic building blocks of making it through some period without, you know, kind of discounting anything else that is not going to help the situation, which is, I think, what you are talking about when you were saying about your own survival in difficult economic situation. Right?
So I have to say, to me, one of the most important things you need to learn, there are thousands of behaviors that waste time and don't contribute to survival. And your most precious resource is time. And you don't have time to engage in those behaviors. So I don't know if I've ever given you one of my famous no whining buttons.
Do you have them?
No. Oh, I had thousands of them. I still have a couple hundred in my den. I can send you one if you want one.
what does it say? Get on with it?
No. It's got it's got the little red. It says whining, and then it's got the red circle around it with the bar across, as in no whining. I was the first person to make one. All the button companies got it after we started it long ago in 1980. It was 1989. Anyway, so, but there are lots of behaviors that don't contribute to success. And what you've got to do is shed them immediately. Not only do you have to shed them immediately, but you can't afford to hang out with somebody who won't. And it's, that's one of the things I've seen a lot. I was told a lot of people didn't survive black budget litigation. And I went back and studied sort of who made it and who didn't and why. And what you realize is the ones who didn't make it just kept practicing behavior that wasn't going to be productive. It's very important to focus what behavior in this situation is productive. And you've got to shed any unproductive behavior.
True, except that I also want to point out that there's another factor called luck. In other words, in even the best circumstances, you may be simply unlucky, or in the worst circumstances, you could be lucky. And that's something that we can call it fate, we can call it luck, we can call it providence, whatever we're going to call it, but unfortunately that exists as well. It's always nice to help luck a little bit by preparation.
Right. Absolutely.
But the factor is there. So what is your next movie that you wanted to talk about?
So there are two movies I want to talk about next. And one of my extreme survival experiences, my urban survival experiences, in the 80s. I was the lead banker in a department, and the head of the department at Dillon Reed decided to take everybody in the department, move the department and our trading floor as well to another firm. And he hadn't discussed it with me, and I controlled the big accounts. So I decided to stay and keep all the business at Dillon Reed, and it turned into a huge fight that went on for years. But I succeeded in keeping most of the business, even though at the time I was only a vice president. Needless to say, it catapulted me up to the partnership and the board. But right when it happened, the first day I went to see, said, I need to see a movie. And I just went out, and as luck would have it, I went to see Trading Places, which is one of my all-time favorite movies. And it was made by one of my all-time favorite producers, who later became a personal friend, Aaron Rousseau. And it's Eddie Murphy and what's his name? you know,
Dan
Eddie
Aykroyd.
Murphy
Dan Aykroyd.
and Dan Aykroyd, right? And the message of Trading Places is the same message in another favorite movies that I used to call my training film, Enemy of the State, which is when you're in a situation that is beyond your expertise and you don't understand what's going on and why, the key to success is to find the guy who understands the environment and can teach you how to operate. So in Enemy of the State, Will Smith finds Gene Hackman because he has no idea how the covert world operates. He doesn't even know it exists. And Gene Hackman, of course, is a longtime NSA guy and, of course, can teach him at high speed how everything works and what's going on and why. In Trading Places, you have Eddie Murphy, who's from the street, and then Dan Aykroyd, who's from Wall Street. So we have the rich on Wall Street and then the hustler on the street. And between the two of them, they have all the knowledge they need to turn around their mutual situation, but they have to get together and they've been positioned as enemies. But they pretty much figure out between the two of them, they have the knowledge they need to win, and so they get together. And it's a beautiful example of where if you can get street knowledge with Wall Street knowledge together, you can. I've always believed you could change the world. And to me, one of the most important things in a survival situation is what I would call actionable intelligence. So in Trading Places, you have these two brothers who are wealthy Philadelphians, very much like all the establishment that tortured me when I was growing up in Philadelphia. Anyway, you have it's Randolph and Mortimer Duke, the Duke brothers, and the Duke brothers get an intelligence operative to basically rig Dan Aykroyd's demise. Okay, so you've got, again, you've got the covert side, just like you do in Enemy of the State. And of course, the key to survival is to get access to the knowledge you need, the actionable intelligence you need to understand what's happening and then to turn it around. So to me, both of them are movies about the importance of actionable intelligence. And if you don't have it, how do you go about getting it? And the speed at which you get it is critical to your survival.
Right. Not to mention the fact that Trading Places is a wonderful comedy, so in those kind of trying
Funniest.
times.
If you grew up in, I grew up in Philadelphia, and if you grew up in Philadelphia, it is really funny.
Well, I think it's worldwide funny,
Oh,
especially if you
yeah.
think
No.
about Jamie Lee Curtis' character and the bear scenes and all the other things that are in this movie that are
Well,
wonderful.
one of the things you saw on Wall Street was we paid a fortune for intelligence. You would make a trade with 3% knowledge, but everybody else had 2%, and 3% knowledge could make you a millionaire or a billionaire. And so everything was about getting the edge on intelligence. And I was stunned when I went, when I said to my attorney, we're going to have to work for individuals. I was stunned to find out that most people don't understand the power of getting that intelligence and trying to build an intelligence edge. And so it's really, it's kind of shocked me being in the different parts of society and seeing the ones that use intelligence to succeed and the cost to those who don't really focus on getting the intelligence they need, what it does to their chances of survival.
Well, I think there's also a common sense that I don't see that much in our current situation that doesn't seem to be applied that much. We can have all the intelligence, meaning we know what we are facing, and then still, the common sense would have been when bad things started happening in China to stock up on, masks and work out, the containment centers for people who are ill but not dying, whatever, things to alleviate or to diminish the overwhelming burden suffered now by hospital centers all over the country. But that's
Right.
my private opinion that, some of it is just common sense that any housewife could have told you that, you know. But that does not seem to have been applied to, you know, to big decision makers. But going back to our survival. So we have now a couple of comedies from you, right? For Monty and Trading Places. We have a wonderful action drama called Enemy of the State. How about, well, I'll throw two movies at you. One is World War Z, and not necessarily even the movie. Even the movie stars Brad Pitt, and it's interesting or fun to watch, especially these days. But also, there's a book, and for me, the book is even much better than the movie because it kind of concentrates on how the survivor in the face of an enemy, which in this case happens to be and kind of overrunning by zombies, but zombies can stand easily as a metaphor for any other disaster. It could be a pandemic, it could be a war, it could be aliens, it could be economic downturn, anything, right? So the zombies have overrun the world, and then the survivors have reported how their countries, respective countries, have survived the attack. And this is compiled by the author of that book, a narrator. And for me, it's a wonderful metaphor of how different countries deal with the problem. You know, literally, you have something like North Korea that is had an attack of zombies, but nobody knows what has happened because the borders are closed and there's a complete silence. We don't know if have they kind of killed them all, have they survived? We don't know. Very North Korean solution to the problem. We have no idea what happened there. And then you have very picturesque characters there. You know, I have some kind of Japanese gamer who is so into playing his game that he's completely oblivious the zombies have basically eaten his town, including his family, and he's still not aware. Then he emerges afterwards. The zombies have moved on. He's a survivor just because he was so engrossed in gaming that he's not aware. So there are wonderful things in this book, and of course, you can literally read it as a horror story with zombies. But I think it's a metaphor for how different political systems and economic systems would have dealt with any kind of a disaster, which I guess to a certain extent is applicable to what is happening right now. So maybe it's a book that is worth rereading with that new angle in mind.
So I never read the book. I saw the movie, which I thought was dreadful, but it has one of my favorite scenes in it, which I've put up on the Salieri Report. And
Which one is it?
it's where Brad Pitt is trying to persuade the family to come with him, and he says, "Movement is life in situations like this. Movement is life." And you know me, I love to travel.
Well, you know, he's not wrong. I mean, sometimes the only way to change the situation is to get the hell out of a place, which actually leads me to a book, actually a book and a movie that I wanted to recommend as a survival story. The book is much better than the movie, as it often happens. It's called The Way Back, not to be confused with the Ben Affleck movie that was released this year. This one is an older release from, I would say, about 2000s. And it's based on a book by Sławomir Rawicz, who was a Polish writer who describes the survival of a group of escapees from a Soviet concentration camp during the Second World War. There's a group of Polish military officers who have been taken as prisoners of war at the beginning of the Second World War when Russia overran, or Soviet Union has overrun Poland. And they are stuck deep in a Siberia concentration camp. Over there, they are also people from other countries, so, you know, various people have been arrested at some point. This is in the middle of Siberia, in the middle of the Second World War, and at some point they all realize that their choice is to die or to escape. There is no third choice. They are not going to survive that camp in the horrible conditions that they are living in. So they get together and they kind of conspire together, and at some point they make a break out of it. And their daring plan is not to be escaping east towards, the native Poland, France, wherever they are from, but to escape east, to go towards Asia, which is not an obvious direction, kind of east south, which they do. It's a true story, which is why the book was written. It's called The Way Back.
So the English title is The Long Walk, and I've read it. I didn't know if you knew that.
Well, I didn't know that it was translated into Polish. I mean, into from
It,
Polish into English, but
No, I read it in English, clearly.
all right. But all I'm saying is, yes, the book is fascinating. The movie is not bad at all. It is kind of star-studded because it has Colin Farrell in it, and I forget right now who is in it, but there's several major actors in it. At some point, they actually. Saoirse Ronan is in it as well. She plays a woman to speak about luck. She's someone who is slightly unlucky. It's a true story, so it's based on a woman that they meet on the way, and basically, there's a question of luck. No matter how brave and hard you are, at some point you either make it or you don't. But it does illustrate, other than describing this incredible adventure when the guys basically escape from Siberia all the way to India through the Himalayas, walking, having nothing. They have no food, no clothes, no nothing. They just escape from a concentration camp, and they walk all the way across Asia. The determination that at some point things get so bad that the only way to survive is to escape, meaning to do
Right.
something maybe incredibly impossible, but is a better solution than not doing anything.
Right. Well, it's the same thing. You face the reality of what you're looking at, and then you take whatever option you have that takes you out of zero chance to some chance.
Right. Now, obviously, there's a lot of uplifting true stories as well that I think just deserve a mention if we are still talking about the survival theme. There is a movie called All Is Lost with Robert Redford, which is about sailing across the ocean.
Oh God, that's such a depressing movie. I
There is a more
hated
uplifting one called The
that
Impossible, which is the survival in the tsunami. I don't know if you've seen that one with, I think his name
Yeah, I
is
have.
Robert.
It's, yeah.
There is one that is pretty gruesome called 127 Hours, which is about a guy who got pinned by a
You know,
rock.
I've never been able to watch that. I just said, I can't do that one.
But I would want to say that these movies at least are. You can look at them this way. At least these are the movies about, incredible hardship and inescapable situation, so that we could reflect on what is happening to all us now and say, well, compared to those stories, and some of them are true stories, our situation is pretty bad for a lot of families that are experiencing economic hardship, but at least, for the majority of us, we are somehow going to emerge from it, maybe a little worse for the wear, but we will emerge and we will survive, using all the strength that we have. But things could always get worse, in other words.
So let me bring up the A-Team. The A-Team was the movie of the year a couple years ago on the Salieri Report. It's the 2010 remake with Liam Neeson, and it has a message that I keep hammering on in multiple movies that I choose. The Bourne trilogy has this message, and that is the government can't help you, you're on your own. So we see in the A-Team a group of very talented, it's sort of a military, elite military team. And they keep thinking that they can trust their commanding general or they can trust the CIA, and they keep getting burnt. And so after a series of, being burnt by the system, they realize, oh, I see. We have to make our own way. We have to make our own world. We're on our own. And that's not so bad. We can do it. And, it's funny because one of the things I said to myself in 1999, the corruption is so bad that I give up on anything having to do with centralization, whether it's government, whether it's media. I don't care about them. I'm not going to give them any of my time. I'm going to make my own way. And it worked. It worked because I didn't lose sleep over trying to get back into something that was gone.
Right.
It was there. There's nothing there. If you care about integrity, there was nothing there. You had to go forward. And I think the A team, I don't know, it does a wonderful job. And so do some of the Bourne trilogies of saying, okay, there's nothing, you can't go back. You got to burn your boats. Go forward.
Yeah, I think that the moral from our conversation, if you like, is that for each of us, I think we have to find some kind of, movies or books that speak to us or have the message, no matter in what improbable place, which is, between Full Monty and The Way Back or The March on, there's a really huge range of type of stories that you can actually find that message in. But the message of, how do I deal with the adversity or with the tough time or where I have no help and I'm on my own or where I have to make decisions that are way beyond my comfort zone just because external circumstances of which I have no control whatsoever forced me to make those decisions and find solutions. I mean, all of us individually have obviously found ourselves in that kind of situation throughout lives. But also now we obviously collectively have those situations. In other words, this is a zombie attack or tsunami or whatever we want to call it, meaning a large force that is kind of pushing out us out of the group that we're in beyond our control. There's nothing we can do. We have to somehow power through it, no matter how it is. So the idea is not to lose sight of what we want to achieve and deal with the problems one small step after another. But for everybody, the book or the movie or the inspiration or the thought would be different.
So let me bring up, it's one you brought up to me the other day, and I wanted to just say a few words about it. There's a real effort in Washington to destroy the US postal system. And I live in a rural area, and for many of the people who live in a rural area, the post office is the heart and soul of the community, and it's wonderful to have a post office. We all have mailboxes or but it's really the center. It's the heart and soul of the community, and the postman coming every day if there's a route. It's a lifeline for so many businesses and people. And if we lose our post offices, it's an essential service that all our lives we've taken for granted, and the time is coming when we could really lose it. And one of my favorite Kevin Costner movies is The Postman, and where the postal service has been destroyed, and so Costner decides to start it again, and he becomes the postman. And it reminds you of all these different things we've had that we take for granted, that now we run the risk of losing. An Amazon drone is not the same thing as going and seeing all my neighbors at the post office.
No, it's not. But actually, I have a different take on it. I mean, I very much hope that the post office does not disappear. But I'm also my take is that if that's where the direction goes on, people will find other ways of connecting with each other, or things don't necessarily end up when they have been intended. So I have a lot of hope that things will not disappear and they will not turn out so dire as you think. But maybe I'm just being an optimist here.
Well, I basically what you see is everyone in Washington is making money from centralizing. And of course, the more you centralize, the more you shrink the pie, you just make the guys at the top wealthier. And at some point you get these collapses. And that's what the Postman talks about, a society where you've engineered some of those collapses. Interestingly enough, that was also a 97 film. I'm picking all these films that were made in 1997. So, are you ready for me to go to my
Yes,
all-time
please.
favorite documentary? This documentary is, if you said what's the best documentary you've ever seen, it would be this one, and it's called The Endurance, and it's the story of Shackleton's Antarctic expedition in 1914. It was made in 2000, and The Endurance was the name of the ship, and it is one of the most remarkable survival tales in the history of in history that I know of. And interestingly enough, and it's a very spiritual story because it's just these are people who wouldn't quit. They would not quit. They would just not quit. And at some point, there are literally moments when you think, oh, well, the angels were carrying them because their ability to get through was just miraculous. But one of the things they managed to do was to bring back the photographs. And so they have photographs of the ship stuck in the ice and all sorts of different parts of the expedition. And so, as you watch the documentary, you get an extraordinary feel. You can really be there with them because of the photographs. And it's another miracle that they were able to bring them back. And of course, by the time they got back, everybody was all caught up in the war. And so, the expedition, because it had failed, never got the kind of attention and credit that it deserved. And I will say this, it's the most extraordinary story of leadership I have ever heard. And when things are very bad and dire, I literally think, I always think, what would Jesus do? But then I think, what would Shackleton do? And whenever I think that, I'm inspired to find a way. So you watch it and you just think, what an incredible species we are. I can do this.
Huh. So this is going to be our pick for the survivor stories that we are recommending. The Endurance, a documentary about Shackleton expedition, and the book Deep Survival by Lawrence Gonzalez. Those two should be the best inspiration of see how horrible things can get and how you can survive a lot of them despite any odds.
But not just survive, triumph. Just triumph. Shackleton triumphed, and the people who you read about in Deep Survival triumph. It's an incredible, incredible testimony to the human spirit and what we're capable of. We're capable of so much more than we know. It's astonishing what we're capable of as a people.
Exactly. I think this is the point where we kind of get to the point that we are happy to end on this positive, hopeful note rather than the drama that we have discussed before. That is also my take on anything in life, that when things go tough, maybe spend an hour or two being transported to some other world through literature or art or movies. Because then when you come back to yourself, you just look around and say, well, that is not so bad then in comparison.
Here's what you do. If you're too tired, and to, you know, and that used to happen to me during the litigation, it was so evil, it was so demonic that you would be so drained you could barely walk across the room. So if you don't have the energy to watch a documentary or read a book, just go to the Food for the Soul website and troll through Nina's columns and look at the eye candy.
Oh, thank you very much. The eye candy actually comes from, old masters of painting like Renaissance or Baroque, not me, but I
It's eye
can guide.
candy for people who have amazing taste.
Yes, but I can guide you through it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Catherine. It was lovely talking to you.
Was lovely talking to you, Nina. You give me food for the soul, and I can't tell you how deeply grateful I am for
You're most welcome. Take care.
it. Bye.